Hello, Catherine here. If you're listening to my podcast because you're a fan of wintering, the good news is that my new book, Enchantment, is available now. It's a book about how we can find a way to reconnect with a world that's sometimes hard to live in and even to find magic there. It's available in all good bookshops and please support your local indie if you can. For more information, you can go to catherine-may.com/enchantment. Happy reading.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Apparently there's a storm brewing today. There were really dramatic red skies this morning. And I've had a look at the forecast. And this afternoon, there's going to be some winds. One of those things that is very enjoyable if you're indoors. But you don't want to be out at sea. It seems like the dog can sense it too. She's really tipped over about the whole thing. Just seems very timid. You wonder if they feel the changes in air pressure more than we do. So I'm getting ready to batten down the hatches. I wonder if my Christmas lights will fall over. I suppose at least they'll take themselves down, right? The lazy person's way to get the Christmas lights down. But we're out enjoying the scenery while we can. I remember once taking my son to the woods just as a storm was coming up, I hadn't realised. And as we got between the trees, you could really feel the wind shaking them. And then they started creaking in this really worrying way. I've never heard that before. It was really obvious that something other or other was going to come down. And so I said, right, we've got to get straight out of here. That's it. We're going. It was really scary. Anyway, don't go into the woods when it's blowing a gale, kids. That's fairly obvious advice. I know you come to me for these nuggets of wisdom. Oh, so good to get out today. I felt like I really needed it. Everything feels really chaotic and disrupted. You get to this point in winter and everything feels kind of stale and dirty. Even I get ready for the sun to come back a little bit. I'm always busy lighting candles to fight against the gloom. It's worth it. It makes a difference. We make what difference we can. So I'm really excited to welcome the poet Maggie Smith onto my podcast this week. She's the author of one of my favourite poems, and I'm sure many of you will feel the same, which is called Good Bones. If you've never read it, Google it. It has a way of speaking to everyone about how we confront a world that's full of terrible things and still feel hope. don't think many people can balance that in the way she does. So I was thrilled when she said yes. And I wanted to talk about her book, Keep Moving, as well, which has been so helpful to so many people going through big changes in their life. And to get a chance to explore her new collection, Goldenrod, which again is full of dark beauty. Anyway, I know you'll enjoy hearing from her. And I'll see you again after the podcast.
Welcome, Maggie Smith. I am so thrilled to have you on the Wintering Sessions. And I'm a really big fan of yours anyway, but I'm really looking forward to talking to you about the ways you've dealt with the darker side of life. And it comes up so consistently in your work, but it's balanced with hope all the time, I think. Is that true to say?
I think so. I mean, I try, right? We try.
Yeah.
And I find, you know, one of the sort of key ways I process the sort of harder, darker, colder side of things is by writing. You get that. And I think as a poet, metaphor is the place I naturally go. And so I find myself in difficult times, and I do this a lot in Keep Moving, looking for metaphors that help me see perhaps how temporary this situation is, or maybe help me, metaphors that might help me reframe it for myself as, okay, it looks like this, sure, but also maybe it could be this other thing. Maybe I could look at it from this other angle. And I find that to be super useful to me.
Like, how do you switch perspective? And I think, you know, you look for like the concrete, like what is this thing that I can use to understand this other thing? That for me is like a real pleasure of being a writer, that you get to go seeking those artifacts that help you to understand.
Yeah, it's like it's sort of like an imagistic shorthand for experience, right? I mean, it's like experience feels so big and amorphous and abstract. And so to be able to say, but it's like this. And to have something concrete and like relatively small and sort of contained and to sort of compare it to, it makes it feel more manageable and more understandable to me.
Yeah. And then, I mean, I think also you then pass that image on to other people and you watch it light up in their mind as well. I think that's just such a nice exchange of gifts in a way. It keeps that, well, that flow, that keeping moving that you talk about. It's that kind of circulation of ideas that we can pass on to other people.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, sometimes it seems very specific to me. If I'm having an experience and I write something down that's an image or a metaphor or something, and I have this really particular association with it. And then I put it in a poem or an essay. And then other people reach out and say, oh, this absolutely reminds me of this one time, or this was exactly what I needed to read, or this is exactly the way I was feeling, but I hadn't quite articulated it for myself yet. And that, I mean, the idea that these really, really specific things can at the same time be somewhat universal or at least portable in ways that you can pass them on to others. I find that magical because that's what I get from reading too. It's like, oh, I feel like someone wrote that just for me. And I know they didn't, but it still feels that way in the moment.
And what kind of reading do you tend to turn to in darker times? Is there something that you reach for particularly?
You know, I tend to read mostly poetry, and then like right behind that, memoir and essays, and then behind that, fiction. So I think my reading is actually opposite to most, at least Americans, which is most people read novels, is like the sort of, and then maybe they read some nonfiction or some essays or memoir, and then last is poetry, and perhaps only when assigned, or on a greeting card. Mm. And so I kind of read in reverse. And poetry for me is always the go-to. I love being able to dip in to a book, and I can keep it on my bedside table, or I have stacks of them just all over my house. And I can pick the thing up and flip to any page and find some incredible marvel.
You know,
and it's just like this little gem. And if I don't have more than 5 minutes, I can shut the book and carry that with me for the rest of the day. And I don't have to remember, where was I in that novel?
It's so portable.
What's happening? It is. It really is.
But actually, and I think there's a sense with poetry that you almost don't want to read more than one or two poems at a time. It actually begins to degrade the experience. You actually want to just keep that very intense, singular relationship with one poem. A long time ago, I was researching a book that never got published, and I got to interview an art historian about what you should do when you go into a gallery, like what were the steps you should take to understand the work. And he said to me, what people don't understand is that you should never try and see the whole gallery. You should see like a maximum of 5 paintings in it and spend some time with them. And then after that, you're exhausted. So go and have a cup of tea and have a look in the gift shop and you're done. And I thought that was so wise, because actually it's often our insecurity that leads us to, you know, try and look at every single painting in every single room. And I actually begin to think that's true for poetry too. Like we need to have the confidence as readers to have that encounter with one or two or three, rather than trying to galumph the whole book down like we might do with a novel.
I love that. I mean, it's a savoring kind of experience, I think. And I think poems are built to be savored. They're not really built to be skimmed, you know, even though they're often short and they perhaps could be. I think of every poem as an invitation to really spend a lot of time with that poem. I actually have a friend who has a practice where every month she reads the same poem every morning.
And so
she just says, this is the month of this poem. And then she reads it every day. And every day it's a different poem, because you're different, right? The day is different. Yeah. The weather's different. Your stress level's different. You're bringing different things to the page. It's offering you different things that maybe you didn't see in your previous 28 readings. And I love that idea of the going into a gallery, you know, really savoring a few paintings or photographs or sculptures and maybe going back and spending more time with those pieces, because you're bringing a different version of yourself to that piece of art every time you go back to it.
You know, part of what he said to me was that means that you need to spend some time before your visit thinking about your visit too. You know, like what is it that you want to see? What is it that you want to have a relationship with today? And it's really changed the way I go to galleries, and I've stopped punishing myself for getting jaded halfway around. I mean, which we all do.
Yeah. Well, and sort of like drinking a few deeply rather than just having little tiny hummingbird sips at every single piece of art, and then leaving and being like, I don't actually remember anything about that. It was just sort of a blur because I didn't actually spend a significant amount of time processing any of those things. Yeah.
It's a lesson for life, as is everything.
Yeah. So there's a metaphor in everything. As my kids
really
say,
is.
We know, Mom, it's a metaphor. I mean, every time I try to say something, they're like, we know, you're going to give us a metaphor. We get it. I'm like, okay,
whatever.
That's because they're everywhere. It's not my fault.
I mean, I think the gift of finding metaphors is not one that should be suppressed.
Thank you. I'm going to write that down and put it on a small calling card, which I will hand to them whenever they complain.
Tattoo it.
Yes, like, indeed.
Look at the tattoo, kids. So I wanted to talk a bit about your collection, Goldenrod, which came out earlier this year. Is it earlier this year in America as well as the UK, or is that just here?
July.
Congratulations on it. It's wonderful. And it's got some of your customary refusal to look away from the dark parts of life. It's like you seem to be a person who has to stare into the darkness rather than try and avoid it. And I sort of noticed that you talked a lot about America, actually, and what is it? What is this country that you live in, and what's it become in these troubled times? I guess that's at the front of a lot of people's minds at the moment.
It is. It is. And it's actually sort of interesting. I've never really written so directly about what people might call political issues, but I don't actually see them as political. I just see them as sort of like, I'm a human being living in this place and seeing these things happen around me. And as a mother and as a citizen and as a writer, I don't know how to not confront some of those things anymore. And yet at the same time, something happened, you know, in the past 5 or 6 years in this country that sort of made it impossible for me to just write about trees. I felt like if I'm writing from my life, so much of what I'm trying to process is not just domestic, as in my home or in my community. It's so much bigger. Like, we're feeling the ripples of these bigger things. And yet, for all of the strife and sort of horror of the past, you know, 5 or 6 years in the United States, it's not really new.
No, it's not.
And so to say, well, suddenly this country is a really dangerous place if you're a person of color, or suddenly this country is a really dangerous place if you're a woman of childbearing age, or it's a dangerous place if you're a child of color, it's a dangerous place if you're a school child of any color. It's not necessarily true, because it's always been an unsafe place for plenty of reasons.
We've kind of lost the luxury of looking away, I guess.
Yes, we have.
Yeah. You are, I noted down a quote from you that was, America, you are grand in theory, poor in practice.
I mean, not what I learned in school. And I think, you know, growing up in a public school system where we said the Pledge of Allegiance every morning, and, you know, stood with our hands over our hearts, and the way that we were taught, you know, the Thanksgiving story and the founding of this country and the Civil War. I mean, just everything we've been taught, looking back on it now and thinking, wow, we sure spackled over a lot, didn't we? How now, as a parent, are my kids being taught, and what has changed, and yet what really hasn't changed, and how...
And has that changed?
It, you know, in some ways it hasn't, in other ways, unfortunately, it really hasn't. I mean, it's, there's still a lot of... I think we like to think of ourselves as the good guys.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, I live in Columbus, Ohio, which is named after Christopher Columbus. So even going back to that story, I mean, I think we just really want to think of ourselves as being like, you know, freedom and equality and democracy and fairness. And those are all great things in theory, but how are those things being implemented, and how were they being implemented all along, and who gets them? Yeah, because they're not resources freely distributed among people.
And, you know, we're going through a similar thing. I mean, but in a slightly different way, in that our reckoning is with like this narrative of empire that we have all been brought up with, and about, you know, the way we were told that things were heroic and adventuring and exciting, and that we brought civilization to these countries. I mean, that is... unfortunately, what we were told when we were at school. I mean, what we did learn about was your history of slavery, you know.
Right,
so we looked
at
other countries in a very critical way, but we didn't look at our own. You know, there's huge gaps in all of our knowledge, and it's painful. I mean, I think it's more painful for some people than others. I think there are some people clinging very, very hard to those, you know, colonial narratives, those narratives of empire. And it's incredibly painful for them to have them wrenched away. But it's the truth, right?
Like,
it's time to look really hard at it.
Agreed. I mean, there's not really a way around that, or shouldn't be a way around that. Although it sure seems like the truth is kind of up for grabs more than it should be.
Yeah, apparently so. Yeah. Yeah. In a really distressing way. And I don't know if any one of us has got a handle on on that and how it works and what we do about it, because there does seem to be a very strong contingent who are saying, but I want to believe this. This is the story I choose to believe, and therefore I choose what truth is. And that's right. Is, I don't know if that's new or not. It feels new. I don't, maybe we've always done it and it's now visible. I just don't know. And I can't ever seem to come to terms with it.
Yeah, I think it's more public now. Mm. You know, seeing whole factions of not just a few odd family members who seem like they want to cling to something, yeah. but whole factions of people and whole, you know, media outlets, frankly,
yeah,
clinging yeah. to true, you know, this version that doesn't really exist in a sort of childlike way. Like, well, this is what I want, so this is what it is. And it's like, well, no, you're an adult. So you yeah. actually have to live in the real world with the rest of us.
Yeah. But apparently people don't, actually.
No, apparently not.
Yeah. We thought they had to, but no, they can't. No. Just carried on. No.
Yes, they can.
But you often write about that in the context of being a parent, you know, and about what, like how you talk to your children about this stuff and what they bring back to you, these terrible knowledges. And you know, I'm really moved by your poem Half Staff about sending children into schools after high school shootings and famous, you know, acts of violence in schools, and how we are constantly wrestling with, you know, the ways that we give our children to the world and how we hold them back from it.
Yeah. I mean, in Good Bones, I wrote about not telling my children things. Mm. And I could do that then, because when I wrote that poem, I had a toddler, you know, and a preschooler. Yeah. So it's different now. I mean, I do have to send them into the world, but I'm also sending them into a world that they're much more aware of. Mm. You know, they hear news, they're learning things in school, their friends know things. I mean, my daughter is going to be a teenager this year. So the idea that I could shelter them from things isn't realistic anymore, but it's also not desirable in a way for me anymore, because again, we have to live in the world as it is, not in the world as we wish it were. And it doesn't actually do them any favors to not know the world they live in, to not be able to see it.
And even if you wanted to, you can't hold it back, because it's change, and that's part of their growing up, is their growing political awareness and their growing critical awareness too. And I share your instinct for wishing that my son didn't know about some of the stuff he now knows about. But it's a ship that will sail with or without my control over it. And the best I can do is talk to him about it, I think.
Yeah, and having us be part of that conversation so they're not getting all of their information from some other kid in the classroom or you know, from, you know, overhearing a bit of television or radio or whatever, being able to have, you know, sensitive, informed conversations and answer their questions. And I've been really heartened, honestly. I mean, my daughter, you know, is in seventh grade and is so much wiser and more aware and just, frankly, more empathetic and a better human than I was when I was in seventh grade. Just a better person, you
know? We talk to them differently, though, don't we? I think, anyway, we talk to them in a very different way. Like, we don't hold much back, I don't think, anymore. And maybe they grow that critical awareness from knowing more about the world and being able to, you know, like, turn it over in their hands and examine it a bit more.
I think so.
But then that's hard, because it's that kind of conflict. And I often think that my son is more innocent than I was over some things. You know, he's like horrified by swearing, which I used to think was, you know, this thing that I wanted to get right into as soon as I could. And also, like, I always wanted like a little sip of, you know, whatever alcohol my parents were having too. Like, I was always really curious about that. And my son is absolutely like, no, that is wine. I'm not interested in that, you know. And I think, wow, that's so different. And it's a change that's happening. Like, on one hand, there's an innocence that I don't think I had. But on the other hand, there's a knowingness that I definitely didn't have. I'm really sure that I didn't understand so much about the world. And I, you know, he's less fearful about difference than I was, without a doubt.
Yeah. Oh, well, that, and how beautiful is that?
Oh, it's great. I mean, he adapted right away to wondering if people, you know, wondering what people's pronouns were. Like, I never had a conversation with him about that. Like, that's something that is absolutely instinctive to him, and like not assuming people are straight and wondering what is racist, like questioning every, like we didn't have that. We didn't have the opportunity to think like that, but they have taken to it with no pain whatsoever. It's not hard on them to do that. They're delighted to, it seems.
Oh, I agree. My son was playing with a sort of wind up toy the other day. That's a butterfly, and you sort of twist it up and let it go, and it flies and flaps around the room. And I said something like, oh, you know, go, that little guy fell under the dresser, whatever, you could go grab him. And he goes, how do you know it's a boy? And I was like, I don't know, I just called it a little guy. And he was like, maybe we should use they, them pronouns, because it's not like we know. And he's nine. And I just thought, you know, that never would have occurred to me. That was not a discussion happening in the 80s when I was his age. And the fact that they really have seamlessly, you know, and it's the same thing. They don't mind wearing masks. It's part of what helps keep them safe and their teachers safe and their friends safe and their grandparents safe. And so I think we can learn a lot from looking at, you know, the people who are kids. Kids and teenagers. They're all right. Like, I feel like we're handing a lot of messes off to them. And I wish they didn't have to clean them up. But I trust them more than I trust people my age and older to do it.
Well, we're clinging to all sorts of things that actually we don't even like ourselves. And I do feel optimistic. But I also refuse to not feel optimistic. I feel like pessimism is a kind of luxury that I don't have. I can't be pessimistic for him. There's a UK poet, Selena Godden. I don't know if you know her, but she has a poem.
Yes.
Do you? Yeah. Pessimism is for lightweights, she says, which is just so perfect.
Yeah.
But I also think that, like, pessimism is something that I can't afford myself. It's not something I can wallow in, because I've got to make everything as okay for him as I can.
Oh, I agree. I mean, I think I would be probably more comfortable wallowing if I weren't a parent.
Yeah.
But I can't. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. It's like, not just because they can't see it, but because I can't be in that headspace and pass hope onto them that I don't have. Like, I need to be able to create that for myself so that I have a reserve to share, because they, frankly, they need it more than most of the other things I have to offer them. Not
Definitely.
That great at helping with the math homework. I'm a decent cook. But the hope, you know, a sense of optimism, despite all of this madness that they're seeing, that I feel like that's my core job, is to make them feel like it will be okay. Maybe not in an easy way, and it will take a lot of work, but that it's redeemable, and that there are, you know, there are things that we can do together to make this world a better place.
I'm just taking a pause to let you know about my very exciting new Patreon feed. If you love the Wintering Sessions and would like to help it grow, you can now become a patron. Subscribers will get an exclusive monthly podcast in which I talk about the books, culture, and the news that are currently inspiring me. You'll also get the chance to submit questions to my guests in advance of recordings, and the answers will go into a special extended edition of the podcast that only patrons receive, and a day early too. Plus, you'll get discounts and early booking links to my courses and events, and your podcast will always be ad-free. If this sounds like your kind of thing, I have a special offer. The first 30 patrons will be able to join at a discounted rate of $3 a month for life. So do get in early and help to build the community from the foundations. Go to patreon.com/Catherine May or follow the link in my bio to subscribe. And please don't worry if this isn't for you. The regular version of the Wintering Sessions will still be free, and I really appreciate your listens. Now, back to the show.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Which leads us neatly to talk about good bones, which I think it would be very hard not to talk about in this context. Yeah. I expect you're probably fairly tired of talking about it, but
no. You know,
this is a poem that has been called the poem of 2016. You know, that's quite a thing to have written something that people just want to keep and pass on like that, isn't it?
It's so strange. I mean, it's the strangest thing because I wrote that poem like I write any poem. I mean, I wrote, I think my most recent poem was from about 2 weeks ago. And I don't think anything amazing is going to happen with that poem. Maybe someone will want it. Maybe it'll be published in a journal. Maybe it'll make it into a book at some point. But I just write poems. That's what I do. Yeah. And so to have one that came about in the same way that any other poem comes about, take on this life of its own, and travel to places I will never go and meet people I will never meet and be translated into language I will never be able to read. It's in some ways that poem's life is a lot more, is a lot wider and more exciting than my own. I'm still here in Ohio. But like, what an amazing thing. I mean, it's a complicated thing for me just because the poem is shared when terrible things happen. So whenever it's shared, I have like a twinge because I'm glad that people are sharing it because perhaps they get some comfort from it. But at the same time, it will always be, I think, associated with, you know, suffering in some way. And that for me is a little odd.
And you can kind of get hijacked by it on any given day, I'm guessing, that you can log into your Twitter feed and find something tragic that you're linked to passively, like through no will of your own. Yeah.
Yeah. I've called that poem a disaster barometer because if I log into my social media and I have tons of mentions, you know, if my social media mentions are just through the roof, and it's because
you know
of good bones.
Something bad has happened.
And so my first instinct is, okay, what happened? Not like, oh, people are reading something I wrote. It's, oh no, what happened? And that's a weird sensation to feel when you're being widely read is, oh no, what happened?
Yeah. It's a very mixed blessing, isn't it? To have written something that people lean on in hard times. On one hand, like I'm always really, like, genuinely happy to help, you know, on a really basic level. But I get that same feeling, really, of discomfort sometimes that, you know, people text me or, you know, like send me messages or tag me into posts when they're at this moment of absolutely terrible loss. And I often feel inadequate in the face of it. You know, what on earth can I say to that person that I feel like I can only let them down in those moments. And it's a tricky one.
I understand that completely. I think that happened with me with good bones and continues to happen. And it happens all the time with Keep Moving. Like, I was joking with a friend the other day that I've sort of become like a divorce whisperer somehow.
I was about to ask you about that. Yeah.
It's the and not just divorce, but really any big sort of life change when people are going through some big, like, oh no, what now moment, which because of the pandemic, it's everyone. We're all going through a big life change and a what now moment. I, you know, mail and DMs and emails and, you know, being tagged in Instagram posts and tweets and it really is, you know, people finding some hope in the words, which is always it's always pleasing for me to see that. But at the same time, I don't know what to say.
No, I know.
Like,
exactly.
I'm so sorry for your loss, or, you know, I'm sending love and strength, or, I mean, there's just, it feels that sort of like, I don't want to answer someone's message with a platitude. Like, I agree. I always feel inadequate. Like, I shouldn't say anything because they already found something in something I'd written that was useful. But I feel like it's terrible to ignore when someone reaches out to say something meant something to them. So it is strange.
Sometimes I wish I was capable of being a little bit more mysterious, but I'm apparently not. I just have to go in there and like blunder in and go, oh, I'm so sorry.
Me too. Yeah. We're in that together.
You want to be nice. But yeah, I mean, let's talk a bit about Keep Moving, because I love the idea of you as a divorce whisperer. I do have a friend who is a divorce lawyer. And funnily enough, she passes on good bones to her new clients. She doesn't pass on Keep Moving.
But oh, I did thrust so
it into
funny.
Well, I don't think she knew about it. So I've now thrust it into her hands to say, I think there's something a bit more appropriate, actually. So writing about a divorce, I mean, you don't write about it in detail. You know, you don't write about the arguments and the comings and goings. You know, I fully respect that. But I wonder what it's like airing that particular kind of laundry, because there's a lot of hope and promise that gets lost when a relationship breaks down, and a lot of kind of public facing, you know, polish, I think, maybe, that you have to let go of to say, OK, well, actually, this wasn't working. Yeah. How did it feel to write about that?
It felt really vulnerable. You know, I've until that book, I'd only published books of poems. And in a poem, even if it's in first person, even if there's an I in a poem, and even if it's relatively close to you as the poet, there's still some sort of artistic distance between the I in the poem and you. And even then, sometimes I would write a poem in third person, and I would ascribe to this she things that I was processing or going through in my own life as a way to sort of hold things at arm's length and not have to come out and say, this happened to me, or this is something I, Maggie, am struggling with. No, it's in a poem. It's not me. And so to write personal essays and to go on social media also and just say, okay, so this is just me. There's no speaker of a poem. Yeah. There's no metaphor. There's no persona. There's no, this is no, it's Persephone. It's told through this other myth, you know? I mean, I've been doing that for years, you know, finding ways to sort of like have a little bit of cover in what I was saying. And both with Keep Moving and actually even in Goldenrod, I've dropped persona completely.
And
I dropped third person. Yeah. It's very direct. And I think in some ways, you know, writing those books basically at the same time and overlapping time, you know, one gave me the courage to write the other and vice versa.
And do you think you'll ever do that again? Or have you put yourself off of writing like prose in such a direct way?
No, I think I'll do it again. It's
addictive, isn't it? In a weird way.
It is. It's a challenge too. And as a writer, I'm always going to, I think, feel most comfortable in poems. That's sort of my home genre. But also genre, when I think about it, is really sort of a construct made so that people know how to sell books and shelve books. And some of the books I love best are sort of like half poetry, half nonfiction. half, something else. And so I like, as a writer, just pushing myself and challenging myself. I would like to try all different kinds of things, because I think really most of the time the content sort of requests the form or requests the container that is best for it. And Keep Moving couldn't have been a collection of poems. I couldn't tell those stories.
No.
I couldn't process it in verse. It just wouldn't have worked.
But I think that's the charm of it, isn't it? Like the directness. I mean, I know they're notes to self, and that they're ways of you talking to yourself to help you get through, you know, what was obviously a devastatingly awful time. But at the same time, I think that, you know, as a reader, that feels like you're urging me directly on. You're like saying, right, okay, come on then, you know, yep, this is awful. What are we going to do next? What now?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of that is that I was talking to myself. So it's all written in second, all of those quotes at least are written in second person. And I didn't even really say until further in that the you in all of those quotes is me.
Yeah.
I'm just sort of pep talking myself through this really dark time. And there was like an element to sort of fake it till you make it of that, where in the very beginning, I'm not sure I felt very hopeful or felt that when something burns down, oh, there's also a space there where something new can be built. But I was like grasping for those metaphors and grasping for those feelings, because I just believed somewhere deep inside that if I told myself a different kind of story about my life, eventually I would get to that place, you know, organically and authentically. And it worked, which surprised no one more than me.
Well, I'm very glad it did. And, you know, you talk about kind of doing positive, like positive is an action. It's definitely a choice, but it's also something that you perform, I guess, until it sticks.
Yeah. And I mean, and now later, having done sort of those daily posts every day, not knowing really what I was doing, it just knowing that it made me feel better. Then later I realized, oh, there's actually science behind that. There's science behind repetitive, positive action, actually rewiring your brain to be more hopeful. Mm. So I sort of stumbled into something real on accident, you know, and writing too. There's science behind not typing, but writing, like physically, you know, pen or pencil to paper.
Yeah.
That you sort of process things more deeply, hold on and retain things in a different way when you're writing physically.
Yeah.
And so it's funny, like finding out like, oh, I was onto something with some of these things, although I was really just sort of flailing in the dark, you know, feeling along the wall in the dark room for a light switch, just hoping to hit plastic at some point. And there it was.
But I mean, sometimes that's the way that we make our best leaps, I think, is to just practice, just to keep doing a thing, like whatever that thing is for you, you just keep doing it and trying to find what your gut's telling you. Because I think it sometimes takes a long time to even know what your gut's telling you if you're in a kind of flailing state. And slowly you begin to glimpse things.
Right. And following the feeling. I mean, that for me was always like, what feels good? Like, does running feel good? Then I'm going to do more of that. Does writing feel good? Then I'm going to do more of that. Like what? Especially in a time where I felt like I was losing a huge part of my identity and my narrative. Like, what could I do today that makes me feel like me? Not me, somebody's wife, not even me, somebody's mother, not me in relationship to all of these other pieces, but just at a core level, me. And if it's, you know, taking a long walk or writing or, you know, dancing like crazy by yourself in your kitchen with music turned up that you love. Like, whatever that thing is, like follow the feeling, because you can't intellectualize that, you know, that you just know.
Yeah. And that's the route back into self, really, or to find a new self that maybe you've never been allowed to have before. And that's the great gift of those moments. And talk to me a bit about about the seasons and what they mean to you, because actually they it comes into your poetry a lot, doesn't it? The kind of shifts in the year, but also there's this real sense of movement in Keep Moving. I mean, like obviously, but you know, there's a sense of time as a sort of healing track, really.
Yeah, I mean, part of it was that you know, my marriage ended and things really got hard in the fall. And I remember walking around and seeing the leaves change and seeing all this beautiful color. And it struck me that all of this beauty is actually coming from decay. Mm. You know, like this is all, it's like, it's sort of a death, but look how gorgeous this decay is. And so trying to sort of, again, reframe change for me. And then, you know, a couple months later, in the middle of the most difficult winter, literally the most difficult winter I've ever had, and looking up and seeing all these bare trees with no leaves and realizing, but look how much sky I get to see now. Like, look at the view through all of these bare branches. Maybe there's something to that too. Like maybe there's something to that. And what's going on underneath the ground? Like, stuff is waiting to come
really
back
good
out.
Really good stuff.
Right? Really good things. And so everything that we celebrate in spring started in winter. Like, that stuff's just been waiting to come out. And so just, you know, reframing things for myself. And I think I think really seasonally, because I live in a place where the four seasons are very distinct.
Yeah.
And I spend a lot of time looking out the windows, because my writing desk is in a room completely surrounded in windows. It's all windows.
Right.
And I spend a lot of time walking in my neighborhood, walking my kids to school and back, walking my dog. So I'm looking at trees and sky all the time. And I don't really know how it just, the metaphors are always just right there for the picking. Thank
They're
goodness.
Just offering themselves to you like low-hanging fruit.
Exactly. I don't even have to search. It's just, the stuff's just right there. Thank goodness.
Oh, well, Maggie, it's been amazing to talk to you. And thank you so much for sharing so much so generously. I'll put loads of notes in the show notes where people can connect up to you and find you. And I'm sure they'll be delighted to come and find you if they've not met you already. But yeah, just a thank you. Your work has given so much to me and so much to loads of other people. And I'm really glad you decided to chat to me today.
Oh, no, thank you. I'm such a fan and this has been a real treat.
Ah, lovely.
It amazes me, even at this time of year, that there are the last few leaves still clinging to the trees. Every gust of wind and a few more fall down. And of course, as I wrote about in Wintering, now that the trees are bare, and if you look closely, there's a bud at the end of every little branch and twig. I never knew they were there until I did my research for Wintering. And now it really thrills me to see it every time. The tree's already. It's really busy at this time of year, doing all the hard work in the woodland. Love to see it. But I also love those amazing, stark lines that the trees make against the sky. It's a pure white sky at the moment. And the trees are reaching up against the whiteness, making these perfect silhouettes. Reminding me of capillaries. One of my favourite sights of the year, let alone of winter. And you can really see that crown separation happening. The idea that the trees avoid each other just by a little margin. So that you get, rather than trees kind of intermingling their branches at the top as you might expect them to, just politely keeping their own personal space. And every time the wind blows, they sway. Just a little. They're not creaking, it's okay. Oh, won't be long until they're in bud. No, I just said they're in bud. Yeah. Won't be long until they're in leaf and it all starts again. But for now, it's okay. I just want to say thank you so much to Maggie Smith for being a brilliant guest. Loved talking to her. I love it that, you know, this age of Zoom allows me to talk to anyone around the world on my podcast. But also I quite often feel a little bit sad that we're not having a cup of tea together. There are benefits and drawbacks. Maybe one day, eh? If you enjoyed that, please do take a look in the show notes. There are links to Maggie's books and her social media presences, as we all have there. So do check them out. She's really worth tracking down. And thank you to the patrons on my Patreon who are making this possible. I think I'm getting used to the language now. Patrons, Patreon. I hope that's right. Such a weird turn of phrase somehow. But thank you. It's been really brilliant meeting the first beginnings of this community, which I hope will grow. And it really supports this little podcast, which I very much enjoy doing, as you might be able to tell. And thank you to my producer, Buddy Peace, composer of the theme tune. Very talented human being all round. Do check him out. He does lots of really interesting things. And thank you to Megan Hutchins, who supports me and the podcast wonderfully, always. And thank you to you, dear listener, for putting up with my ramblings while I walk through the woods with an increasingly muddy dog. I'll see you all really soon, back in a couple of weeks. Bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.